What's up, Chicago?
And the Oscar goes to?
I'm Erin Allen, and this is Curious City.
Sinners.
Recently, Autumn Derald Arkapaw won an Oscar for cinematography for the movie Sinners. It was a historic moment. She's the first woman ever to win an award in that category in the Academy's 98 years. And she's of Filipino and Black Creole descent. When she was speaking to the press right after the win, it was clear that the moment wasn't lost on her.
A lot of little girls that look like me will sleep really well tonight because they'll want to become cinematographers. And I know that. Like, I know that, you know, I'm here, so.
Quoting Karen O from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, she said, "You have to see you to be you." Autumn, congrats. Last episode, we looked into the first art galleries in Chicago. Unsurprisingly, those early established spaces in the 1800s were run by white people who mostly curated art by other white people. But that didn't mean there wasn't a lot of art being made and displayed by Black and Indigenous people at that time. So today, in the spirit of Autumn Derald Arkapaw's historic win, we're going to look at a time in Chicago's history when Black photography started to boom and what it meant for the community. It really was an era of you have to see you to be you.
I think that these images writ large, all of these images coming together and circulating, definitely changed consciousness.
Amy Mooney is a professor of art history at Columbia College, Chicago. She's working on a project with the Newberry Library called Say It With Pictures. It focuses on African-American commercial photography in Chicago at the turn of the 19th century. Early on, photography was not considered fine art. As Amy puts it, the medium was seen as a transcription of life. But then things started to change. In 1900, the Art Institute had one of its first photography exhibitions. It was curated by a man named Alfred Stieglitz, one of the biggest advocates of photography as an art form. Also around this time, Black photographers started their own professional studios. In Minneapolis, photographer Harry Shepard established a school for Black photographers in 1906. The firm Sexton & Maxwell opened a studio in St. Louis, and then one in Chicago.
There were kind of franchises that were starting to expand. By 1913, Miles Webb established the Practical School of Photography here as well. And he was actually advertising in a nationwide journal that was put out by the NAACP called The Crisis.
Photography for Black people at the time came with economic independence. People were the bosses of their own studios. And that was an important part of countering the narrative of what Black people were portrayed as. Key to that were photographs that circulated in various publications in the early 1900s. These were images of beauty products, church congregations, social clubs. And this was possible in part because of the Great Migration.
They're coming into northern cities at this time looking for opportunities, everything from education to establishing businesses. And because of some of the redlining and segregation in many of the cities, we find Black populations clustered together. And we still have this extent, obviously, here in Chicago. But what this does do is it allows African Americans to patronize other African Americans and to be really mindful of thinking about that patronage as political.
We see that in the form of Black businesses supporting each other. A major example was businesswoman Marjorie Stewart Joyner. She had an impressive resume. She oversaw beauty schools and led beauty brands. She also hired Black photographers to help promote her business, like a photographer named Artie Jones.
She goes to Artie Jones and hires him to make the images and works with him to make images that she finds flattering for her patrons, that absolutely complements her business.
These photos were circulated in local magazines that would be the precursors to Ebony and Jet, and they were seen internationally. And that visibility was very important.
When we think about African-American art history, we're always celebrating the Harlem Renaissance. But also Chicago was really contributing to that visualization and to that circulation. So media, businesses, Great Migration, those are definitely the kind of right circumstances to really support the photographers and make a demand for that.
Like today, the subject matter of photos in the early 1900s ran the gamut, from celebratory pictures of weddings and babies to everyday life. While many of these photos served customers, some photographers really viewed the medium as a form of high art.
Others were seeing themselves as really cultivating a kind of black subjectivity and offering that to them. Woodard's, for example, advertised that if you wanted to have a portrait that gave style, class, and dignity, well, they were the studio for you to come to.
The Woodard she's talking about is William E. Woodard, a renowned photographer who had studios here in Chicago, St. Louis, Detroit, and for a brief time, New York City. And he was in stiff competition with another renowned black photographer, James Vanderzee, who had a studio right around the corner from him.
What's kind of interesting is at some point the photographers know of each other and are in some ways competing, yet they're also really supportive of each other's work. And this is so true of other black entrepreneurs.
And it wasn't just men. There was another company known as the Electric Studio, which was co-owned by a woman named Charlotte Page Carroll.
She establishes this business and on her business card proclaims that she is the only African-American woman photographer. So to have that bold statement and to call out race, particular, and gender, she's doing some work with that business card. And I found the business card in the files of Scotty Piper, who was a tailor who did the bespoke suits for Duke Ellington and all the other, again, phenomenal jazz musicians that came through Chicago. This kind of circular skein is what really interests me about the interactions and the way that one recommended the other and built on the other.
Tell me about the community and just the sort of social interaction or what you might call social practice of taking and making photographs between people.
I really like that question, the idea of a social practice and process. It was interesting to me to learn how social photography was, especially when I've been studying Woodard's. And Woodard had his studio written about a lot in different magazines. So that's why I was able to kind of learn so much about this. And when he opened up a new studio down on 47th, he established salons, like parlors, where you would come in and you would be seated and greeted, maybe offered a refreshment. And then you had the opportunity to see on the wall all of the photographs he's taken, and then there would be albums and just different examples. And when he talked about it in his ads, he said, you know, come and make a call. Whether you take a picture or not, that doesn't matter. And so in his sense, he was community building. He was building certainly a taste and awareness of his brand, but he's also trying to connect people.
Woodard didn't discriminate on the basis of class. Anybody was welcome to sit for a photo.
Woodard took photographs of everybody, from Ida B. Wells to random performers who came through his door. So it's not quite as, divisive, I think, of an experience as we previously thought.
Why might one think it was divisive?
Well, I think because of this idea of the politics of respectability, that there were, you know, club women and they went a certain place, and then there were, you know, women working in the beauty salon and they went a certain place, but instead all of the people were, you know, again, engaged in each other's, if not doing each other's hair, then certainly still patronizing the same venues.
Now, maybe you're already hearing echoes of respectability politics, which is a strategy to counter prejudices, stereotypes. It was complicated and not always helpful, but images showing black people as quote unquote respectable were meant to disempower white supremacy.
We have people like Ida B. Wells coming and performing a type of respectability. You know, she's wearing her pearls. She's very straightforward in her countenance, not smiling or anything like that. Yet she also has a very clear decision of a button on her blouse that speaks to the recent lynching of a variety of African-American soldiers. So she does one, too, both and. And I think that this is is one way to look at the photographs from this time in broad strokes, is to, again, see them as individuals and the specifics of their accomplishments and who they are, but also then to imagine how this was a counter sphere to a Black identity that was belabored by the history of these stereotypes.
Wow. So I guess I was thinking about it in terms of like exhibiting the photographs and maybe distributing them. But this is even in the subjects and what they chose to wear and how they chose to be staged, for instance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, it is a self-expression, right? It's an opportunity to put on your best. It is also the idea that you have decided that you are worthy of getting your photograph done, right? So, and it takes time, it takes effort, and you're investing in it.
So where could you see these photos? Lots of places. Clubs, theaters like the Regal Theater, which had exhibition space. Companies like the Chicago Defender displayed photos in their offices. And some museums started exhibiting photos in the early 1900s, too.
But it's not, to my knowledge, until 1927, when we have the Negro in Art Week exhibition, that photographs by African Americans were included in that particular opportunity.
The Negro in Art Week was a landmark exhibition in Chicago in 1927. It featured sculpture, modern paintings, and applied arts to highlight Black creativity. But exhibitions and displays weren't beholden to a stationary space. Sometimes the works were meant to travel. Amy says the Newberry Library recently acquired a set of glass lantern slides. These are photo images that were transferred to glass slides, and then with light, the images were projected onto a wall. And these specific slides were commissioned by the Methodist Episcopalian Church, which was a predominantly white denomination. She says their motivation was to continue the church's work of abolitionism. The slides show Black life in Chicago, church congregations, women's sewing circles, children, basketball teams. And the set was meant to be a touring display, particularly for Black people in the South.
And an agent would take it into Southern churches or community centers and show these images along with a kind of set script to encourage migration, to show these beautiful spaces where Black congregants gathered, to show these support systems, to kind of, again, encourage the opportunity to think that, oh, we can go north and we can take this risk. You know, such an opportunity, yet also consequential.
I'm just so struck by this concept of an image and an art piece as a showing of what life could be or a tool of invitation.
Sure. I think the idea of a tool of invitation, that's really beautifully phrased. I'm going to have to borrow that for sure. But thinking about, again, remember, we're in a really different media space right now. Imagine being in a darkened room and seeing beautifully hand-colored, tinted images shown through a kind of pool of light and projected large scale in a room. So this is a different mediated experience than what we take, you know, for granted with our movies and our digital technology and all of the things that we are bound to. So you could imagine going into that phenomenal church with the wide boulevards and tree-lined streets that are part of Chicago's infrastructure at this time. Mm. And imagine, again, if you are living in abject poverty, you know, in a cabin with all the histories of enslavement right there. Wow, that must have been such a possibility.
Amy says all of these images, the slides, the photos in magazines and newspapers, it changed consciousness.
And I mean that by how people saw themselves as well as how they were seen. And I think that that's a really important legacy for us to be aware of. And it merits then the opportunity to do things like have this conversation or put together an exhibition or the various publications that we've been working on as well.
Amy Mooney is an art history professor at Columbia College. She's working with the Newberry Library on an upcoming exhibition called Say It With Pictures, which will open in June 2027. episode of Curious City was produced by me, Justin Bull, and our editor, Susie Ahn. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, you can send them our way at curiouscity@wbez.org, or you can visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.